The falcon landed on my arm before I even saw it coming. 1 second I was invisible, the way I always was at these gatherings, pressed against the stone wall of the great hall with a wooden cup in my hand that I hadn't touched. And the next, every single person in that room had gone completely silent, and every single pair of eyes had turned toward me. I didn't understand what was happening at first. I felt the weight before I saw it. Talons wrapping around my forearm through the sleeve of my gray dress. The pressure firm but somehow gentle, like a hand choosing to hold rather than grip. When I finally looked down, my breath left my body. The falcon was enormous. Brown gold feathers caught the torchlight and turned amber, then copper, then almost red. Its eyes, sharp, impossible, ancient, were fixed on my face with an intensity that made my chest ache with something I couldn't name. A leather strap hung from its leg, stamped with the royal seal of the Northern Pax. Everyone in the hall knew what that seal meant. This was Caius's falcon, the Alpha King's falcon. The bird that hadn't allowed a single hand to touch it since the day it was brought from the Eastern Mountains 3 years ago. Handlers had tried. Trainers had tried. Pack lieutenants, visiting nobles, even children who'd been nudged forward as a kind of joke. All of them had been met with snapping beak and furious wings. And now it sat on my arm, like it had always lived there. "That's impossible," someone behind me whispered. I agreed with them completely. My name is Grace, and for most of my 24 years, I have been the kind of person rooms forget. I grew up in the outer settlement of Veldmore, a cluster of wooden houses at the edge of the Northern Pax territory, the sort of place that appears on maps only because someone had to write something in that corner. My mother had been a healer of modest gifts, my father a man who left before I could form a clear memory of him. I had pale blonde hair that turned silver in winter light, and a face that strangers sometimes called kind, but never striking. I was not weak, but I was not powerful. I was not chosen, but I was not cast out. I existed in the narrow space between notice and dismissal, and I had spent most of my life learning to be comfortable there. That comfort had carried me through 3 years of working as a record keeper at the Northern Keep, a position that required precision and silence, both of which I had in abundance. I catalogued births and deaths, land agreements, and trade routes. I sat in rooms where decisions were made, and I wrote them down, and no one asked my opinion, and I never offered it. I was the gray woman in the gray dress behind the gray desk, and I had told myself, on more than one occasion, that this was fine. Today was the gathering of ranks, the annual assembly where the Alpha King formally received his pack lieutenants, heard their reports, settled their disputes, and reminded every person present exactly where they stood in the order of things. I had attended 4 of these now, each time as a scribe, each time standing at the edge of the room with a leather-bound journal and a piece of charcoal, recording what was said. I had seen Caius from a distance at each of them. He was not a man who blended. He stood well over 6 feet, with dark hair kept short, and a jaw that looked like it had been cut from the same gray stone as the keep walls. He did not smile often, and when he did, it was the controlled, deliberate kind. The smile of someone who understood that expressions were a form of language and chose his words carefully. His eyes were dark brown, almost black in certain light, and they moved through rooms the way a general surveys a field, methodically, missing nothing. He had never looked at me. That was fine. I did not need him to. I was at the gathering because the head scribe, old Brennan, had taken ill the day before, and I was the only one available to fill his place. It was not an honor. It was a practical solution to an administrative problem. I had dressed as I always did, gray wool dress, hair braided back, nothing that would draw attention, and arrived early, as I always did, and pressed myself to my usual wall, and waited for the proceedings to begin. The falcon had other plans. Even now, with the bird still settled on my arm, and the silence of the hall pressing against my ears like water, I couldn't explain why I didn't flinch. Every rational instinct I possessed said to move slowly, call for a handler, apologize profusely for whatever I'd accidentally done to attract the creature. Instead, I stood completely still and looked at it, and it looked at me, and the rest of the world receded to a kind of gray background noise. It made a sound, low, almost conversational, nothing like the sharp call it used during hunts. More like a question. I don't know either, I told it quietly. I heard someone near me inhale sharply. Only then did I remember that I was not alone. When I finally looked up, the first face I found was Rena's. She was one of the senior pack women, tall, red-haired, impeccably dressed. And she had been kind to me exactly once, on my first day at the keep, before deciding I was too unremarkable to invest in. Right now, her expression was a complicated knot of emotions she wasn't bothering to untangle. Disbelief, irritation, something that might have been the earliest ancestor of envy. Beyond Rena, I found Lieutenant Devon, who oversaw the eastern border settlements. He was watching the falcon with narrowed eyes, the way a man watches a weather pattern he doesn't trust. Beyond him, I found Caius. He had not moved from his position at the head of the room. He stood exactly as he always stood, shoulders straight, hands loose at his sides, expression unreadable. But his gaze had found me, and it had not moved. And something in the quality of his attention made the room feel smaller. He was not angry. I had been prepared for anger. He was something else entirely. Something quieter and more difficult to categorize. He took one step forward, then another. The crowd parted without him asking it to. My pulse did something complicated and embarrassing. The falcon shifted on my arm, turned its head toward its owner, and then, inexplicably, impossibly, turned back to me. Caius stopped 3 feet away. Up close, he was even more still than he appeared from a distance, the kind of stillness that wasn't absence of motion, but perfect, intentional control. He looked at the bird. Then he looked at me. His eyes were darker than I'd expected, and more attentive. And there was a line between his brows that wasn't quite a frown, but lived in the same neighborhood. "What's your name?" he said. His voice was low, not loud, not commanding in the way people sometimes performed command. It simply expected to be heard, and the room heard it. "Grace," I said. "I'm the record keeper. I'm standing in for Brennan." He nodded slowly, still watching me with that careful attention that made me feel like a document he was trying to read in bad light. "She's never done that," he said. Not to me, but not quite to the room either. More like a private observation that had accidentally become audible. "I know," I said. "I'm sorry. I didn't do anything." "I know you didn't." Then the strangest thing happened. The corner of his mouth moved. Not a smile, not quite, but the beginning of the thought of one. The faintest shift of expression that came and went so quickly I would have doubted it if I hadn't been watching him closely. He extended his arm. The falcon looked at it, looked back at me. And then, with all the reluctant dignity of someone doing a favor under protest, stepped sideways onto his forearm and allowed itself to be reclaimed. But as Caius turned to walk back toward the head of the room, the bird craned its neck and kept its amber eyes fixed on me until the distance made it impossible. And Caius, just before he reached his seat, glanced back too. Just once, brief and unreadable. I pressed myself back against the wall, opened my journal, and held the charcoal with fingers that were only slightly unsteady. Around me, the whispering had already started. The whispers followed me out of the great hall like smoke. I stayed until the last formal address was recorded, my charcoal moving steadily across the page even when my thoughts refused to stay in order. I wrote down land disputes and border agreements and a disagreement between two lieutenants over water rights near the Southern Creek, and I kept my eyes on my journal and my expression neutral, and I told myself that the strange stillness I felt was simply the aftermath of surprise. By the time the assembly adjourned, I had filled 11 pages, and my hand ached, and I wanted nothing more than to return to the small records room on the second floor where things made sense and nobody looked at me. I made it as far as the corridor outside the hall. Grace. I turned. Rena stood in the doorway, arms crossed, two of her usual companions flanking her like decorative columns. She had the expression she always wore when she was deciding how to reclassify something. A merchant reassessing the value of goods she'd previously overlooked. "That was quite a performance," she said. "It wasn't a performance." "No?" She tilted her head. The record keeper, pressed against the wall, suddenly chosen by the king's own falcon in front of every lieutenant in the Northern Territory. She paused to let that framing settle. "Convenient." I looked at her steadily. "I was standing still. The bird landed. I didn't train it. I didn't call it. I didn't do anything except not panic. And yet here we are." She smiled, the kind that didn't reach anywhere near warmth. "Just be careful, Grace. Attention like that has a way of making people expect things from you. And expectations have a way of exposing exactly what people are made of." She left before I could answer, her companions trailing behind her like the tail end of a warning. I stood in the corridor for a moment, breathing slowly. Then I went upstairs to my records room, closed the door, and sat at my desk, and looked at the wall, until my heartbeat returned to something reasonable. The next morning arrived gray and cold, the kind of late autumn day that settles over the northern keep like a wet cloth. I was at my desk before the sun had fully cleared the tree line, transcribing the previous day's proceedings from my rough charcoal notes into the formal ink record. The work was methodical and absorbing, and for an hour I managed to exist inside it completely. Then Brennan's assistant knocked and told me I was expected in the Eastern Wing. I didn't know the Eastern Wing well. It was the administrative heart of the keep. The rooms where Caius met with his council, reviewed reports, made the decisions that I later recorded in careful, neutral language. I had been there perhaps twice in 3 years, both times to deliver completed record books to a waiting lieutenant. The assistant led me to a room I hadn't entered before. Not a formal council chamber, but something smaller, lined with maps and shelves of territorial documents. Morning light came through two narrow windows and fell across a long table covered in papers. Caius was standing at the table when I entered. He wasn't alone. A man I recognized as Aldric, the king's chief strategist, sat to one side with his own papers, and a younger lieutenant named Corvin stood near the window. But Caius was the first thing the room showed you. The way certain objects in a painting pull the eye before you've consciously chosen to look. He glanced up when I came in. "Sit," he said, not unkindly, just directly. I sat. "You transcribed yesterday's proceedings." "Yes." "Brennan will need another week at least. I'd like you to continue." "Of course," I said. "That's not a problem." He nodded and returned his attention to the papers on the table, and I thought that was the end of it. But then he said, without looking up, "How long have you been a record keeper here?" "3 years. Veldmore, originally." I went still. "Yes." Now he looked up. "I read the border settlement reports. Veldmore appears in them occasionally." He paused. "Difficult winters." "Yes," I said again, because it was true, and because I didn't know what else to add. He studied me for a moment with that same quality of attention from the day before. Careful, assessing, not unkind. Then he said, "The Falcon's name is Sable. She's been with me for 6 years. She has never willingly gone to another person." I wasn't sure if this was an explanation or an accusation, so I said nothing. "I'm not asking you to explain it," he continued. "I don't think you can. I'm telling you because I think you deserve to know that what happened yesterday was not ordinary. Across the table, Aldrich was looking at his papers with the focused attention of a man pretending very hard not to listen. Corvin, near the window, had abandoned any pretense and was simply watching. "I understand," I said carefully. "Do you?" There was nothing sharp in the question, just genuine curiosity. "I understand that it was unusual," I said. "I understand that people will have opinions about it. I don't understand why it happened, and I'm not going to pretend otherwise." Something shifted in his expression. Slight, like a door opening a fraction before someone decides whether to open it fully. "That's an honest answer," he said. "I don't have another kind." This time, I was certain of the movement at the corner of his mouth. Small and brief, and immediately controlled. But there. He returned to his papers. "You can begin today's record when the morning council convenes. Aldrich will show you where to sit." I was dismissed. I rose, nodded, and followed Aldrich toward the door. "Grace." I turned back. Caius was still looking at his papers. "Sable is in the east courtyard in the mornings. If she approaches you again, you don't need to report it." I left the room with that sentence sitting strangely in my chest, warm and inexplicable, like an ember I didn't know what to do with. The days that followed established a new pattern, and patterns I had learned were how ordinary things became permanent. I attended the morning council. I sat in my designated corner with my journal and recorded what was said with the same quiet efficiency I always brought to the work. The lieutenant spoke. Caius listened and responded. Aldrich offered analysis. Corvin, who I was learning was younger than he looked and considerably more observant than he let on, occasionally said something that cut through a complicated debate with the cleanness of a good blade. I recorded all of it. I remained invisible. But at some point during the third morning, I noticed that Caius occasionally paused before giving his final word on something, a brief, fractional pause, and glanced in my direction. Not expectantly. Not as if he wanted me to speak. More like a man checking a compass. Quick, habitual, almost unconscious. I told myself I was imagining it. The east courtyard appeared in my mornings almost accidentally. My route to the records room passed near it, and on the fourth day after the gathering, I had slowed without meaning to near the archway that opened onto the cobblestones and the old oak tree where the falconry post stood. Sable was there, unhooded, standing on her post with the loose feathered ease of a creature utterly comfortable in her authority. She saw me the moment I appeared in the archway. She made that same sound from the great hall, low, conversational, somewhere between a greeting and a question. I stood where I was. "I'm not coming closer," I told her. "I don't want to cause trouble." She made the sound again. "You're very persuasive for a bird," I said. I didn't go closer. But I stayed in the archway for a few minutes, and she stayed on her post, and we regarded each other in the pale morning light, with the comfortable quiet of two creatures who had, through no planning of their own, become something like familiar. I was so absorbed in this that I didn't hear the footsteps behind me until they stopped. "She's been restless in the mornings," Caius said. "Until now." I turned. He was dressed plainly. No formal layers, just dark wool and boots. And he looked different somehow. Slightly less assembled. Like a letter before it's been sealed. "I didn't come here to disturb her," I said quickly. "I know." He stepped past me into the courtyard, and Sable immediately stood straighter, lifting her head toward him. He raised his arm, and she stepped onto it with practiced ease. But her eyes, as always, found me over his shoulder. "She's not restless in a distressed way. She's been looking for something." He paused. "I think she found it." The morning cold moved through the courtyard. Somewhere above us, clouds shifted, and a watery shaft of light fell across the cobblestones between us. "Why does it matter?" I asked. "That she chose me?" Why does it mean anything? He turned to look at me directly, and for just a moment, the controlled stillness dropped enough to show something beneath it. Not weakness, exactly, but depth, like a lake that had looked shallow from above. "Because Sable has never been wrong," he said quietly. He walked back inside. I stood in the courtyard alone, my pale hair catching the weak morning light, my heart doing something I hadn't given it permission to do. Above the keep, the clouds moved on, and the sun, hesitant, northern, cold, came fully into the sky. The council chamber smelled of wood smoke and old paper, and I had learned to read its moods the way sailors read water. When the lieutenants arrived already arguing, the air tightened before anyone sat down. When Aldrich spread his largest maps across the table, the morning would run long, and someone would leave frustrated. When Caius entered with that particular quality of stillness, heavier than usual, more deliberate, it meant that whatever was coming had already been decided, and the discussion was less a debate than a formal announcement. On the morning of the 11th day since the gathering, he entered that way. I was already in my corner, journal open, charcoal in hand. Corvin took his place near the window. Aldrich arranged his papers. The three border lieutenants, Devon from the east, a broad woman named Petra from the north, and a quiet older man named Sethan from the west, settled into their seats with the resigned posture of people who had been summoned rather than invited. Caius stood at the head of the table and said, "There's been movement along the Ashvale corridor." The room changed. I had heard the Ashvale corridor mentioned in passing, in the margins of old territorial records, in the careful diplomatic language of reports that chose their words the way people choose footing on uncertain ground. It was a narrow stretch of land between the Northern Pack's western border and the territory held by the Greyvale faction, a group that had been, depending on which record you consulted, either a minor rival power or a significant threat, managed through decades of careful distance. "What kind of movement?" Petra asked. "Organized," Caius said. "Scouts and patterns, not exploration. Assessment." Devon leaned forward. "Assessment of what?" "Of us." The silence that followed was the kind that fills itself with everyone thinking the same thing, but nobody saying it first. I wrote it all down. Movement along the Ashvale corridor. Organized scouting patterns. Assessment of Northern Pack strength and positioning. My charcoal moved steadily, and I kept my expression neutral, and I listened with the particular quality of attention I had developed over 3 years. Not just recording words, but recording what sat beneath them. What sat beneath this was fear. Carefully managed, professionally contained, but present. "We have three options," Aldrich said, spreading a map. "Respond with a visible patrol increase, which signals awareness but also readiness. Send a formal message requesting explanation, which gives them an opportunity to claim innocence. Or wait and gather more information before moving." "Waiting is always a choice," Sethan said. He was the oldest person in the room, and he spoke rarely. But when he did, people heard it. "It is not always the passive one." "The risk," Caius said, "is that while we wait, they finish their assessment. And then we're responding to a decision already made." He looked at the map. Then, briefly, he looked at me. Not for long. Not in a way that anyone else would have caught. The lieutenants were focused on Aldrich's map, and Corvin was watching Caius, and I was the person in the corner who wrote things down. But I caught it, and it stayed with me through the rest of the morning. Afterward, when the lieutenants had dispersed and Aldrich had rolled his maps and the room had exhaled, Corvin appeared at my corner with two cups of something hot. "You look like you've been thinking hard," he said, offering me one. "I always think hard. It's a professional habit." He sat on the edge of the table with the casual confidence of someone who had grown up in rooms like this and never felt the need to justify his presence. He was perhaps 26, with a quick face, and eyes that held more seriousness than his easy manner suggested. "You're not what I expected," he said. "What did you expect?" He shrugged. "Someone trying harder. After the Falcon, most people, if that happened to them, would be making sure everyone remembered it. I'm not most people." "No," he said, looking at me with mild curiosity, the way you look at something that has surprised you pleasantly. "You're not." He paused. "Caius asked me to tell you that today's records should be copied in triplicate. One for the main archive, one for Aldrich, one to be sealed." I nodded. Sealed records meant sensitive material. They went into the locked cabinet in the east wing, accessible only to Caius, and now apparently me. "He trusts you with that," Corvin said. It wasn't quite a question. "He trusts the position," I said carefully. Corvin smiled. "Sure," he said, in the tone of someone generously declining to argue. "Rena found me in the corridor 3 days later. This time she was alone, which was worse. Rena in company performed. Rena alone was simply direct." "I want to understand something," she said, falling into step beside me with the proprietary ease of someone who owned the hallway. "You've been here 3 years. You've been invisible for 3 years. And now suddenly you're in the sealed council. You have access to restricted records, and the Alpha King's Falcon refuses to leave you alone." She paused. "What changed?" "Nothing," I said. "I do the same work I always did. But the context changed." "I didn't change the context." She stopped walking, and I stopped with her, because ignoring Rena entirely was a tactical error I'd learned to avoid. "I'm not your enemy, Grace," she said. And oddly, I believed her. Not because she was warm, but because she was practical. And practical people didn't waste energy on enemies they didn't need to make. "But there are people in this keep who are watching what's happening and drawing conclusions. And some of those conclusions are not kind." "What conclusions?" "That you're positioning yourself. That the record keeper role is a cover for something more deliberate." She held my gaze. "I don't believe that. You're too genuinely unassuming for it to be performed. But belief isn't the issue. Perception is." I looked at her for a long moment. "What would you like me to do about other people's perceptions?" She almost smiled. "Nothing. I'm just telling you to be aware of them." She paused. "And to be careful. The Ashvale situation has everyone's nerves exposed. When people are afraid, they look for something to blame that isn't the actual threat." She walked away. I stood in the corridor and let that land. It was Sable who found me when the fear arrived, not the managed professional kind that filled council chambers. The personal kind, the one that came at night when the work was done, and there was nothing left to occupy the mind's careful arrangements. I had gone to the east courtyard in the early evening, which I hadn't done before. The day had been long, and the sealed records had contained things that were difficult to write in neutral language. Details of what the Ashvale scouts had reportedly seen. Assessments of vulnerabilities. Projections that used words like, "if they move first, an estimated response window." And my chest had been tight since mid-morning. The courtyard was quiet. Sable was on her post, hooded for the evening. When she heard my footsteps on the cobblestones, her head turned toward me with unerring accuracy despite the hood. I sat on the low stone bench near the old oak. I didn't say anything. I just breathed the cold air and looked at the darkening sky above the keep walls and let the tightness in my chest do what it needed to do. Sable made her sound. Twice. Then she went quiet and simply existed in my direction, which was, I was learning, her particular form of company. "I don't know how to be visible," I said eventually, to her, to the courtyard, to no one. "I've been invisible so long it's become the thing I'm good at. And now..." I stopped. "Now the room doesn't forget me anymore, and I don't know what to do with that." "You do what you've always done." I did not startle. "I don't know why." perhaps because some part of me had registered the footsteps without consciously processing them, or perhaps because his presence in this courtyard was no longer surprising. But I turned, and Caius was standing at the entrance to the courtyard, with his arms loosely at his sides. And he looked again like a letter before it was sealed, slightly unguarded, slightly more present than the council version of himself. "Which is?" I asked. He walked to the other end of the stone bench and sat, not close, just present. "You pay attention," he said. "You record things accurately. You don't say more than you know, and you don't pretend to know what you don't." He paused. "Those are not small things, Grace. Those are the things I spend most of my time wishing people around me could do." Above us, the first stars were appearing in the northern sky, faint and cold and very far away. Sable shifted on her post and settled. "The Ashvale situation frightens me," I said. I hadn't meant to say it.
"It should," he said.
"Anyone who isn't frightened isn't paying attention."
"Is that supposed to be reassuring?"
"No," he said. "It's supposed to be honest." I looked at him. In the evening dark, his profile was all clean lines and quiet tension, and there was something in the set of his shoulders that I recognized. The particular posture of someone who carries responsibility the way other people carry weight. Not dramatically, not bent under it, just always present.
"You're afraid too," I said. He was quiet for a long moment.
"Yes," he said. The word fell into the courtyard like a stone into still water. Simple, real, the kind of admission that costs something. Sable made her low sound as if in approval. And I sat beside the Alpha King in the cold northern evening, the stars coming out above us one by one, and felt, for reasons I could not have explained to anyone, least of all myself, that I was exactly where I was supposed to be. The Ashvale message arrived on a Tuesday, which felt wrong somehow. Terrible things should arrive on days that feel terrible, gray Mondays, bitter Fridays, not ordinary Tuesdays with pale sun and the smell of wood smoke and bread from the kitchen corridor. I was at my desk when Corvin appeared in the doorway of the records room, and I knew from the way he was standing. Too still, weight slightly forward, the posture of someone carrying something they want to put down quickly, that whatever he was about to say would change the shape of the day. "Council," he said. "Now." I closed my journal and followed him. The chamber was already full when we arrived, which was unusual. Beyond the regular council members, there were two people I didn't recognize, a man and a woman, both travel-worn, with the careful, watchful quality of experienced messengers who had learned that their job was to deliver words exactly and then become furniture. Caius was standing. He was always still, but this was a different quality of stillness, the kind that precedes action rather than reflects calm. He looked at me when I entered and nodded once, which I had learned meant sit, record everything, miss nothing. I sat. I opened my journal. I held my charcoal ready. "Greyvale has made a formal claim," Aldrich said, addressing the room. He looked like he hadn't slept. "They assert that the Ashvale corridor falls within their original territorial boundaries under the old founding agreements, and that the Northern Pack's presence there constitutes an encroachment." "The founding agreements are 300 years old," Petra said flatly.
"Yes, which is exactly why this claim is being made now, when the surviving copies are incomplete and the interpretation is contested." Aldrich's voice was careful, academic, the voice of a man who preferred problems to have clean edges. This one didn't, and he knew it. "They're not claiming they want a fight. They're claiming they want a conversation."
"Conversations with Greyvale," Devon said, "have historically ended with them having more than they arrived with."
"Agreed," said Seathan quietly.
Caius had not spoken yet. He stood at the head of the table with his hands resting flat on the map,
and I watched the room wait for him the way a compass waits to find north. "What's the ask?" he said finally. The female messenger spoke for the first time. Her voice was steady, professional, accustomed to delivering words that belonged to someone else. "Lord Greyvale requests a formal summit, neutral ground, within the month." She paused. "He requests that the Alpha King attend in person." The room absorbed this. Attending in person meant leaving the keep. It meant traveling to neutral ground, which was always, in practice, slightly less neutral than advertised. It meant showing up, which was a gesture of both respect and vulnerability. And in the language of territorial politics, those two things were often indistinguishable. "He knows you'll come," Corvin said quietly. "Because not coming is worse." "Yes," Kaia said. "I wrote all of it down. Every word. Every pause. Every implication." My charcoal moved across the page and my handwriting stayed even, and I did not allow the tightness in my chest to reach my hand. But I was thinking about what Sethan had said weeks ago. Waiting is always a choice. It is not always the passive one. And I was thinking about something else. Something I had noticed in 3 years of reading territorial records. Something that had settled in the back of my mind as a pattern, without my consciously deciding to look for it. The founding agreements. I had transcribed references to them, not the agreements themselves. Those original copies were old and contested, as Aldrich said, but references, mentions in land dispute records, citations in old correspondence. A detailed summary, careful and thorough, in a record book from 60 years ago, written by a scribe whose handwriting I knew because I had spent 3 months cataloging her work when I first arrived. I had read that summary. I remembered it clearly. I remembered it because it had been meticulous, and because its author had included something that Aldrich, apparently, had not. A notation about a secondary clause, tucked into the third addendum of the original agreements, that explicitly defined the Ashvale Corridor as a shared transit zone, rather than an exclusive territorial claim for either signatory. I stopped writing. I looked at the table. At the map. At the shape of the conversation moving toward a summit that might not be necessary, toward a concession that might not be required, based on an interpretation of an agreement that might not mean what Greyvale was claiming it meant. Corvin was watching me. He had a quality I'd come to appreciate. He noticed things without making them into events. He raised his eyebrows slightly. "Something?" I hesitated. 3 years of invisibility is a long practice. The habit of silence runs deep, deeper than I sometimes knew until something pushed against it. But I thought about what Caius had said in the courtyard. "You pay attention. You record things accurately. You don't say more than you know." I knew this. "Excuse me," I said. The room turned. Every face, all at once. I had not spoken in a council session before. My voice came out quieter than I intended, and I straightened my spine against the instinct to disappear back into my corner. "The founding agreements have a third addendum," I said, looking at Aldrich rather than at Caius, because looking at Caius right now felt like standing too close to a fire. "It defines the Ashvale Corridor specifically. There's a summary in the regional records, written 60 years ago by a scribe named Marit. The notation describes the corridor as a shared transit zone, not an exclusive claim." Aldrich stared at me. "You've read it." "I cataloged Marit's archive 3 years ago. I read everything I cataloged." "You remember a specific clause from a document you read 3 years ago?" "I remember everything I read," I said. "It wasn't pride. It was just true. The way having pale hair was just true. Something I'd been born with that I'd never thought to announce. The summary is in Archive Box 14, East Records Hall, second shelf from the floor. If the original agreements say what Marit documented, then Greyvale's claim doesn't hold under the terms they themselves are invoking." The silence was different from the one that had followed the messenger's words. That silence had been heavy with decision. This one was recalibrating. Caius looked at me. I made myself look back. "Get the box," he said to Corvin, who was already moving. The document was exactly where I said it was. Corvin returned in 12 minutes. I counted them, sitting in my corner with my hands folded and my expression carefully managed, and set archive box 14 on the table. Aldrich opened it with the focused urgency of a man who needed to be wrong and hoped he wasn't. He read in silence. Then he read a section again. "She's right," he said. The room breathed. "The third addendum is explicit," Aldrich continued, his voice shifting into the measured tone of someone converting shock into usefulness. "Ashvale is defined as a shared corridor. Neither party holds exclusive claim. Greyvale's argument depends on ignoring this addendum entirely, which they may be counting on us not to notice." "Or counting on it being lost," Seathan said. "Or that," Aldrich agreed. Caius had not moved. He was still looking at the map, but the quality of his attention had shifted. He was processing. I had learned to recognize this, the particular internal stillness that preceded his decisions. "We still attend the summit," he said finally. "But we attend with the third addendum. We don't demand. We present." Devon nodded slowly. "That changes the shape of the conversation." "Yes," Kaya said. "That's the point." He looked at me again. Not briefly, the way he usually did. Long enough to be a choice. "Well done," he said. Two words. Quiet. Direct. I felt them land somewhere in my chest and stay there. What I did not expect was Rena. She came to the records room that evening, after the council had dispersed, and the box had been returned, and I was alone with my transcription. She stood in the doorway for a moment before speaking, and she had the expression of someone doing a calculation that kept coming out differently than expected. "I owe you an adjustment," she said. "You don't owe me anything. I told you to be careful of perception. I implied that your presence in that council was about positioning." She paused. "It wasn't. I was wrong." I looked at her. "You were working with the information you had." She studied me with something that was closer to genuine curiosity than anything she'd shown me before. "How did you know? That document. That clause." "I read everything I catalog. Everyone says that. I mean it literally." She was quiet for a moment. Then, "I've been in this keep for 9 years. I've attended more councils than I can count. I would never have remembered that document." "You weren't looking for it. Neither were you." "No," I agreed. "But I'd already seen it. Sometimes the work is just being in the right place and paying attention, and then being willing to speak when it matters." She nodded slowly. Something had shifted in her face. Not softened, exactly. Rena was not a soft person, and I didn't think she would become one. But the particular quality of dismissal that had lived in her expression since my first day was gone. She left without saying anything more, which was, from Rena, its own kind of statement. That night, I went to the east courtyard one more time. Sable was awake, unhooded. She was looking at the sky, the great, cold northern sky, with the absolute attention of a creature that understood instinctively that she was built for it. I sat on the bench. I looked up with her. After a while, I heard footsteps, and I did not turn around. Caius sat at his end of the bench. We looked at the sky together in the particular silence that had developed between us over weeks. Not empty, not awkward, but inhabited. The kind of silence that two people only reach after they have said true things to each other and survived it. "The summit is in 3 weeks," he said. "I know." "I'd like you to come." A pause. "As the record keeper. The official record of the proceedings should be accurate." "It will be," I said. Another pause. Longer. "And because I trust your attention," he said quietly. "In rooms where attention matters." Above us, The northern sky was enormous and indifferent and full of stars, and Sable lifted her head toward it. And I sat beside the Alpha King and felt for the second time that strange, unearned sense of being in exactly the right place. Only this time, I didn't question it. I just looked up at the stars and breathed the cold air and let it be true. The neutral ground was a place called Harrow's Field, a wide, frost-covered valley between two low hills, far enough from both territories to be technically honest about its neutrality, and close enough to both borders to remind everyone present exactly what was at stake. We arrived on horseback in the early morning, our breath and the horse's breath rising in identical clouds against the cold air. Caius rode at the front with Aldrich and Petra flanking him. Corvin rode beside me, which I suspected was not accidental. Devon and Sethan completed the party. Six people, deliberately modest, the size of a group that said we are confident without saying we are armed. I had never been to a summit before. I had recorded accounts of them. The formal language, the careful phrasing, the way decisions that would reshape territories got written down in neutral, bloodless sentences. But sitting at a desk reading about something and sitting on a horse watching it approach were entirely different experiences, and I spent the first half of the ride reminding myself to breathe evenly. Greyvale's party was already there. Lord Greyvale was a tall man in his 50s, broad-shouldered and gray-haired, with the particular bearing of someone who had spent decades being the most powerful person in most rooms and had arranged his entire self around that assumption. He had four people with him, an advisor, two witnesses, and a younger man who stood slightly behind him with Greyvale's jaw and his eyes and the unmistakable posture of a son learning to inhabit his father's shape. They watched us ride in. Greyvale's gaze moved across our party and settled on Caius with the assessing focus of a man doing arithmetic. We dismounted. The formal greetings were exchanged. Names, titles, the ritual acknowledgement of neutral ground. I took my place slightly to the side, journal open, and became, as I always did, the person the room forgets. Except that Greyvale's advisor, a thin woman with sharp eyes and careful hands, looked at me once and then looked again, and I understood that she was doing the same thing I was. Recording. Assessing. Noting who was present and why. I nodded to her slightly. She nodded back. Professional recognition. One record keeper to another. Then the summit began. Greyvale made his claim with the confidence of a man who had rehearsed it. Elegant. Structured. Referencing the founding agreements. With the selective precision of someone who had chosen which parts to cite and which to leave in the archive. I wrote it all down. Aldrich responded with equal formality, outlining the Northern Pack's position and their understanding of the corridor's status. Measured, careful, giving nothing away. Greyvale's advisor leaned toward him and said something quietly. Greyvale nodded and allowed himself a small, controlled expression of certainty. The expression of someone who believes the next move is theirs. Kaya said, "We'd like to address the third addendum." The expression didn't disappear, but it shifted. Aldrich placed the document on the table, not the original, which remained sealed in the archive, but a careful transcription, witnessed and signed, that I had prepared in the 3 weeks between the council and today. Every word from Marit's 60-year-old summary, rendered in clean, unambiguous ink, with citations pointing back to the archive box and shelf. Greyvale's advisor picked it up. She read it. I watched her face, because her face was more honest than Greyvale's, and what I saw there was the specific expression of someone who has just discovered that the foundation they were standing on has a crack. She showed it to Greyvale without speaking. He read it. Slowly. Then again. The frost-covered valley was very quiet. Somewhere above us, a bird called once and went silent. "This notation," Greyvale said carefully, "is a summary, not a primary source. The primary source is in the Northern Pack Archive, Caius said. You are welcome to request access. The addendum is consistent with the summary. The interpretation is explicit, Aldrich said. Shared transit zone. The language doesn't require interpretation. It requires reading. The summit didn't end there. These things never ended cleanly in a single moment. They continued through 2 more hours of careful, formal exchange. Of positions being adjusted without being announced as adjusted. Of the gradual, face-saving process by which a claim becomes a negotiation and a negotiation becomes an agreement. But the shape had changed. Greyvale had arrived expecting to move a boundary. He left having agreed to a joint stewardship arrangement for the Ashvale Corridor, both packs with access rights, neither with exclusive claim, a formal document to be signed within 30 days. Not a victory in the dramatic sense. Not a defeat for Greyvale in any way he would have to announce publicly. Just a resolution. Clean, documented, grounded in what had actually been written 3 centuries ago by people who had apparently been wiser than those who came after them. As our party mounted to leave, Greyvale's advisor approached me. Good work, she said quietly, with the directness of someone who didn't trade in unnecessary words. I just read what was there, I said. She smiled, small, genuine. That's the whole job, she said, and walked back to her horse. We rode home through the afternoon, the light turning gold and then amber as the sun dropped toward the hills. Corvin rode beside me for a while, and he was quieter than usual, which meant he was thinking, rather than choosing not to speak. Eventually he said, You know what you did back there. I read a document. Grace. I looked at him. You changed the outcome, he said simply. Not with strength or rank or history. With attention and memory and the willingness to speak at the right moment. He paused. I want you to know that I see that. That the people in that room see it. I didn't know what to say to that. So I looked at the road ahead and let the silence carry it. When we returned to the keep, the courtyard was lit with torches against the early dark. Stable hands came for the horses. People dispersed toward warmth and food, and the particular exhaustion of sustained alertness finally being released. I was crossing toward the records hall when Caius said my name. I turned. He was standing near the entrance, and he had the look of someone who had decided something, and was now executing it with the same directness he brought to everything. Walk with me, he said. We walked to the east courtyard. Sable was there, awake, watching the darkening sky. When we came through the archway, she turned her head toward us, toward me, and made her sound. The low conversational greeting that I had come to understand was hers alone, reserved for exactly this. We stood near her post. The courtyard was quiet. The first stars were appearing. Caius was quiet for a long moment, and I had learned to wait within his silences rather than fill them. When I brought Sable back from the Eastern Mountains, he said finally, she was young and completely untamable by every measure anyone had for measuring such things. Every handler said the same. Gifted bird, impossible temperament, would never fully trust. He paused. I kept her anyway. Not because I knew she would change, but because I understood something about creatures that don't trust easily. He looked at Sable. They're not broken. They're just waiting for something real. I looked at the falcon. She looked back at me with her ancient amber eyes. I've been running this territory for 8 years, Caius continued. I have good lieutenants. I have Aldrich, who is the best strategic mind I've ever worked with. I have Corvin, who will be exceptional in ways he hasn't finished discovering yet. A pause. What I have not had is someone in that room who remembers everything, speaks only when they know, and isn't performing anything for anyone. I was very still. I'm a record keeper, I said carefully. Yes, he said, and I'd like you to remain one, officially. He turned to look at me. chief archivist of the Northern Keep. Access to all records, presence in all councils, authority over the historical documentation of this territory. A position that has existed in the founding charter and been vacant for 11 years because no one filled it adequately. I looked at him for a long moment. "That's not," I started. "It's exactly what you already do," he said, "with the authority to match it." I thought about the gray dress and the corner and 3 years of being the person rooms forgot. I thought about Rena's face when she said I was wrong. I thought about Greyvale's advisor. That's the whole job. I thought about Sable landing on my arm in a silent hall and the whole room turning. "Yes," I said. It was a small word, but it carried everything. Winter came to the Northern Keep the way it always did, completely, without apology, transforming the world into something austere and clear. The joint stewardship agreement for the Ashvale Corridor was signed within the 30 days, as promised, with both parties' witnesses present and the documentation filed in triplicate in the archive. Greyvale's faction remained what it had always been, a neighboring power with its own interests. But the shape of the relationship had changed, and shapes, once changed, rarely returned entirely to what they were. Aldrich told me, with the quiet satisfaction of a man who appreciated elegance, that the third addendum had likely saved two territories from a conflict neither of them wanted and neither of them could easily afford. "All it took was someone who read what was there," he said. Corvin was promoted to senior lieutenant of the eastern border in the early weeks of winter, a position he had been ready for longer than anyone had formally acknowledged. He accepted it with the slightly stunned look of someone who had been expecting to wait longer, and then immediately began doing the job so naturally that within a week it seemed like he'd always held it. Devon retired to his family's land in the south, which he had been planning for 2 years, and which everyone pretended was a surprise. Petra remained at her northern post, unassailable as the hills she oversaw. Sethan continued to attend council, and continued to say little, and continued to say it in ways that mattered. Rena and I were not friends. We were not built for it, and neither of us would have wanted the particular softness that implied. But we had become something more honest, and in its way more durable. Two people who saw each other clearly and worked in the same space with mutual respect and the occasional sharp exchange that both of us enjoyed more than we admitted. I moved into the chief archivist's rooms in the east wing, larger than my old quarters, lined with shelves, smelling permanently of old paper and dust and the particular intellectual comfort of accumulated knowledge. I organized the archive in ways that had needed doing for decades. I attended every council. I read everything. And in the mornings, before the day assembled itself into its official shape, I went to the east courtyard. Sable was always awake. She always made her sound when she heard my footsteps. She always regarded me with those amber eyes that held something older than either of us, something that understood instinctively what it had taken me 24 years to begin to learn. That being chosen is not about being the loudest or the strongest or the most visible. Sometimes it is simply about being genuinely, patiently, completely present, and waiting for the world to notice. Caius came to the courtyard most mornings, too. We talk sometimes about the territory, about records, about problems that needed the kind of slow, careful thinking that benefited from cold air and the company of a falcon who had no patience for pretense. Sometimes we were quiet together, which had become its own language, one we had both learned to speak without trying. There was nothing dramatic about it. No grand declaration, no single moment of transformation. Just the gradual, ordinary accumulation of mornings, of trust built word by careful word, of two people who had both spent too long carrying things alone learning, slowly, what it felt like not to. And Sable watched over all of it from her post with the absolute authority of a creature who had known, from the very first moment, exactly what she was doing. On the last morning of autumn, before the first real snow, I stood in the east courtyard, with my face tipped up to a sky the color of pale iron. And I thought about the girl from Veldmore, who had pressed herself against walls and practiced invisibility, and told herself that was fine. She had not been wrong to survive the way she survived. She had not been wrong to be quiet, to be careful, to keep her head down in rooms that didn't ask for her voice. Sometimes invisibility is not defeat. Sometimes it is the long, patient work of becoming. But she had been wrong about one thing. She had thought that being unseen meant being unimportant. She had confused the absence of notice with the absence of worth. Sable stepped from her post onto my arm, unbidden, unasked, simply choosing, the way she always had, and regarded me with her ancient amber eyes. "I know," I told her. "You tried to tell me from the beginning." She ruffled her feathers with the dignified satisfaction of someone whose point has finally been understood. Behind me, I heard footsteps on the cobblestones. The familiar weight of a presence that had become, over one strange and ordinary autumn, the thing the morning organized itself around. I didn't turn immediately. I looked at the sky one more moment, the iron gray sky of the north, enormous and cold, and full of a beauty that didn't ask for your comfort before it showed itself to you. Then I turned, and the courtyard held everything it needed to. The falcon, the frost, the first snow beginning to fall in slow and patient flakes, and two people standing in the cold morning light with nothing between them but honesty and the long, quiet road of what came next. The story didn't end with fire or transformation or a single moment that rewrote everything. It ended the way real things end. Not with a dramatic closing, but with an opening. A door swung wide. A choice made not once but daily, in small and ordinary acts of courage. Grace of Veldmore, chief archivist of the Northern Keep, a woman with pale hair and a memory like still water, who had spent 3 years being invisible and one autumn learning that she never truly had been. She was exactly where she was supposed to be. And this time, she knew it.